Hello, and welcome to the new Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For more than 7 years, over 300 interviews, I've been speaking to my colleagues in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. Today is a special Art of the Cut interview celebrating the 20th anniversary of a landmark in cinema, Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings, which premiered in theaters in December of 2001. Collaborating with Jackson in the cutting room was John Gilbert, ACE, who was nominated for a BAFTA, an Ace Eddie, and an Oscar for his work on the film. Since editing Lord of the Rings, Gilbert's films have included Bridge to Terabithia, The Bank Job, The Killer Elite, and Chasing Mavericks. John has been a previous guest on Art of the Cut for his work on the movies Adrift and Hacksaw Ridge, a movie for which he won a BAFTA and an Oscar and was nominated for an Ace Eddie. I'm thrilled to have him back on the show to discuss this epic film and the decisions, discussions, challenges, and victories of editing Lord of the Rings. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for film professionals of all types. This has been 20 years since you cut this movie, more than 20, correct?
2001, that's right. It was the end of 2001. So it's the anniversary must be within 2 weeks' time, I think, of the actual release.
Yeah, I think so. And obviously you finished editing before the movie was released.
It was pretty tight, actually.
Oh,
it was pretty tight. We were supposed to be finished in September so that we could go into sound. Now, we're supposed to be finished at the end of August, and we weren't quite finished, and they had lined up the orchestra in London, the London Philharmonic, for September, and Peter wanted to keep cutting. So I upped sticks and went to London, and I was cutting in the morning, and he was recording with the London Philharmonic in the afternoon. Then 9/11 happened while we're in the middle of that, and I couldn't go home. So Peter thought, oh, well, let's get them to send some more footage over and we'll keep cutting. And it was early days of electronic editing as well, well, reasonably early days. So getting a large amount of material to London from Wellington was quite complicated, but they managed it. You know, he's a terror for getting things done. So, I ended up, you know, reworking a number of scenes, and some of them they then re-recorded the music with the Philharmonic after I'd reworked some scenes. So, you know, and then the sound mix, it was right up against it. Peter likes to work right till the end. Came out in December, but it was still being worked on in November.
Joe Walker, who you probably know, a fellow editor, he asked, how do you survive an edit that lasts this long? Like, the shoot itself was over a year, or was that for the whole trilogy? How long were you actually getting dailies?
The intention was for the first year, they would shoot all three movies and they would schedule it so that if they were in a particular location like Hobbiton or Rivendell, they would shoot the material for three movies there. So that was the stated intention. But the reality was he really only concentrated on material for the first film over that year. And he had second unit and multi-unit directors doing battle scenes and stuff for the other movies. So I had that first year, I had dailies coming in. And there were some days when there was material for other movies, but most days I had, you know, 60-70% of the time for a year I had material coming in. And then the following year I started working with Peter, and pretty soon we decided we were going to reshoot some scenes and shoot some new material. So there were rewrite and there was an 8-week pickup shoot. It was being rewritten continuously, and it was a 2-year job for me. I started, I'm pretty sure it was September 99, that's right, and finished through in November 2001. And then Peter said, well, come back. I just want you to, there's some material we want to put back for the DVD. There was a bit of a push-pull. I mean, the film was quite long. It ended up just under 3 hours. But quite often there was a scene where I thought, I like to keep things moving. And Peter's the sort of person who likes to have everything in. So there was a bit of tension there. Sometimes I'd say, well, you can put this on the DVD. Beginning of 2002, I went back for a month or so and retrieved a lot of the stuff I'd managed to pull out of the movie and made the longer version, which went out in the DVD.
It's an interesting dynamic. Peter's the director. How much push and pull could there be? Like, how much did you feel comfortable saying, I think this scene needs to be shorter, when he's pushing to make it longer?
I always felt okay. I always felt I could say it, you know, but he was the boss. And if he wanted it in, it was in. Sometimes I would nag him a bit and maybe I would win. Maybe when there's someone else in the room, and I said, look, we really need to take this scene out. Maybe Fran would pipe up and say, yes. Well, actually, I can remember times when she disagreed and Peter agreed with me. I think you've got to say what you think. And I'm a sort of an editor, I like to keep things moving forward. I don't want to lose the audience's attention when the story becomes static or repetitive. Peter likes maybe things to play a little bit longer in places, I guess. So, you know, it was a little bit of a tension, but I think it's a good tension. I think it's my job to hold him to account, to justify why things are there. And it could be in the end to just be, I like it, I love it, and I want to keep it in, you know. But it comes down to that. He's the director.
Just challenging it, even if you don't get your way, that helps the director, right? It helps them strengthen or clarify their creative choices.
Yeah, I think the conversation is important. And I think bringing up ideas sometimes, even though the director doesn't necessarily agree with that, another idea comes out of the conversation and you make discoveries through the conversation. I like that part of filmmaking. I like the to and fro of the creative conversation. And I make discoveries myself in the conversation.
The discussion you have about one scene can help you edit another scene.
Yeah, that's right, because you're talking about the underlying themes of the film and what's important taking the story forward, or what's the underlying themes or message of the film or whatever, and how you're going to integrate that in a subtle way. There are lots of layers to films, the overall momentum of the film, and you feel something's necessary early on, but it stops, and then you think, okay, we must find a way of integrating that material later in the film. And I think repetition is a killer for films. Yeah, no, the conversation's what I love about it.
Do you remember structural changes that were made to accommodate story rhythms that you felt like things had to change?
The overall structure was pretty true to the original script, I seem to remember. There was material added to the Black Riders. We strengthened them in the pickups too, now I think about it. More material was added in that area, and we dotted that through the film.
There were obviously a bunch of deleted scenes on YouTube and the DVDs you talked about. Can you think of any of the reasons or any of the discussions why those scenes were cut?
Quite often I would say to Mike Horton, who was cutting the second film, I've got a great scene for you here. I don't think it belongs in movie one. I think you should have it. So that was a sort of a running joke with us. There's a great scene with Bilbo and Frodo, and he pulls out the sword and he gives him the sword and everything. And then there was a scene where they're gathered at Rivendell getting ready to go. And there's a moment between Arwen and Aragorn. And I said, look, we've been here in Rivendell so long. I think after the scene with Frodo and Bilbo, we should cut to them on the road. And we lifted that scene out. Yeah, I think that was a momentum thing.
You were talking about the Black Riders, and there are scenes with the chase to Rivendell with the Black Riders. And then there's calmer, quieter moments like the romantic scenes in Rivendell. Can you talk about the regulation of the fast scenes compared to the slow scenes, or did that feel like the script was correct and the scenes that were fast and slow worked the way they were supposed to in the script?
I think they worked the way they were supposed to. I mean, Peter's very good at that. He's very good at working out which scenes are meant to be energetic and tension. The scene where Frodo's on the road to Bree, actually they go to Bree where they meet Aragorn, the scene where they hide underneath the tree and the Black Rider comes along, I think that was shot, that was the very first day of the shoot. It was a great scene, I think. And the Black Riders chase them down and they're on the boat and the horse pulls up on the wharf. It's sort of material you look at and you think, oh yeah, I can make something out of this. Peter was very, very good at that. The interesting thing though with the scene when Frodo looks down the road and he gets a sort of a spine-tingling moment and says, get off the road, because the other hobbits are playing up. They're sort of naughty hobbits. And the scene didn't quite work. We had a point of view shot of him looking down the road. I'd put it together and Peter was saying, well, it doesn't really work. And I said, well, why don't you shoot a track zoom of his POV? And so the second unit guy went up there and he shot the track zoom a few days later and I put it in, which really made it work. I was pleased to have that idea, and it just made it a sort of a slightly supernatural moment. It was sort of early days of visual effects. It was a big learning curve for everyone. Originally, it had something like 500 visual effects shots in it, which you look at a film like that these days and it would have 5,000 visual effects shots in it. there was a lot of motion control, a lot of technology which not really used anymore, because the hobbits were obviously supposed to be 3 foot six in shots with people of normal size. So they were all scaled motion control moves so that you could shoot them and put them over the top of each other. And it was technically quite challenging. It was certainly more than anything I'd ever done up till then.
How were those shots with the hobbits delivered to you? Did you have split screens to try to get the hobbits in, or before you had VFX?
If they were blue screens, sometimes the pass was on a blue screen. So I would get like a sync pop between the two pieces of film. So I would line them up in the Avid and put them over the top of each other and go through and find the pieces I wanted and make a rough comp of them and cut like that.
This was 20 years ago. Obviously, as you said, early days of NLE, I'm assuming Avid?
Yeah, it was Avid. It was Avid. I had cut two or three films on Avid. It's interesting because Peter worked with Jamie Selkirk on his earlier film, and Jamie's a film guy, and they were cutting on a Steenbeck. Interestingly, they were doing The Frighteners on a Steenbeck, and they had quite a lot of visual effect shots, similar sort of visual effect shots with Michael J. Fox and some ghosts wandering around, similar problem. And they didn't really know how to deal with it on the Steenbeck. So I got a call and I went in there and I cut a lot of the visual effects scenes on an Avid. It was a bit of an eye opener to him, not only what I could do effects wise, but how quickly I could work compared to working on a Steenbeck. That was a great thing for me. And that's how I got to do Lord of the Rings, really. Peter was used to editing. He would shoot and then he would start editing once he finished shooting. Like, he didn't edit during the shoot. Obviously, with Lord of the Rings and New Line and all the pressure, you know, you couldn't shoot for a year and then start cutting. It took a little bit of him getting used to someone digging in and cutting his material while he wasn't there. And he's not one of these filmmakers that doesn't understand the process. He understands it all the way through.
What was your collaborative methodology, or his, in the editing room? Can you describe kind of how he likes to work, or how you like to work?
He would have a very definite idea of what he wanted. And I had already done an assembly of the film. I would play him that. And he'd say, well, you know, I'd like to start the film with this shot here, if it was different to what I'd chosen. So what I would do is I would go and find that shot and I would stick it on the front of my assembly and then play into my assembly. There was some stuff which I'd put together which worked, and we were able to just say, yeah, it's working, move on. And there were other things where he got in and we got over it with a fine tooth comb.
It's almost, as you said, a 3-hour film. Is there a challenge story-wise to a film that long for an editor?
A 3-hour film, and it was a 3.5-hour film for a while as well. I like to watch the whole film, and if it's 3.5 hours long, that's quite challenging to sit down and watch it. It's so different to watching a sort of 100-120-minute film. It's a lot longer. So just holding it in your head and keeping the sense of the momentum of the film is more challenging, for sure. But yeah, no, we tend to work on it in chunks, in like 20-minute chunks. The Rivendell section, the Hobbiton section, and work on them as chunks. We didn't watch it as a whole film all that often, I've got to say.
Do you remember how long the first assembly was?
I would guess it's something like between 3.5 and 4 hours, but I assemble the films quite tight. I don't like to leave things long and leave a lot of choices. I tend to try and make something that works. And if there's a different version, I'll make a different version with other material in it, but I don't like to have just sort of a long series of choices. I like to make an assembly that plays. When you say the first cut, there were so many pickups and reshoots. So the film was constantly sort of like an accordion. It would get longer and shorter and longer and shorter as new material came in and the material got excised from it. It was an unusual project, there's no doubt.
Do you remember temping music?
We did temp. Yeah, we did temp. And it's interesting that we had a lot of interesting music. I used something from The Fly at one point. I used a little bit of stuff from Gladiator, and there was all the usual things, movies, films from the 90s, late 90s. There was something from The Fugitive, I remember. It was all film music. It was all film music we used.
Looking back, can you remember any specific scene or sequence that you're proud of? You remember like, oh, that was a big challenge and I'm very happy with it.
Boromir's death. There was a lot of material for that scene. And Peter said to me, don't touch that material. I want to cut that with you. So I put it to one side, and you know, a few weeks went by and I had to get a cut ready for, there was some deadline. So I sort of closed the door and spent 3 days on that material. Interestingly, I heard later on, oh, Peter really liked what you did with that. He didn't comment for quite a while, but it just stayed there. And I was really pleased with that particular scene.
Is it difficult collaborating with somebody, or is it an advantage to collaborate with someone who's also a writer?
Everyone's different. If you're collaborating with someone who's also a writer, they sometimes have an allegiance to the way things were on the page. Whereas if it's a director coming in with someone else's script, they'll have things in their head that they wanted to do a little bit different to what's on the page. I don't mind if they've written it or they're just the director. You've got to say if you think something should be different to what's on the page, and maybe someone who hasn't written it might be a little more receptive. I don't know. It depends on the person. Some writers might be protective of their work, but most directors, you know, they're interested in making the scene as good as it can be. And what's on the page is one thing. They can't always manage to shoot what's on the page exactly how they want it to be. So it's the old saying, there's the movie you write, the movie you shoot, and then there's the movie you edit. So I think most directors understand that. First-time directors, maybe not quite so much. That's more of a challenge, I think. You know, if it's their first time out and they haven't been through that process, maybe they have less understanding of that.
Totally makes sense. You mentioned that there were shots that you told Michael Horton, hey, I got a scene for you. maybe you can take this. Did it happen the other way around? Or
I had enough scenes. I wasn't taking anything from them. The first film is about the fellowship getting together. And at the end of the film, they split up. So the second and the third films were separate threads of these characters out on their own, whereas the first film was a group thing. And so, I mean, they actually had some flashback material in the second and third film. So that's how I felt that they could use some of that material.
I told some people that I was doing this interview, I said, got any questions? And one of them that you should love is, this film was a masterclass of editing slow motion and normal speed together. How did they decide? And that's a question I ask actually often, is that transition between coming in and out of slow-mos and regular speed, is there a trick to it? Do you treat them differently, or is it all just treated like footage?
It's a question of finding the right moment, what's dramatically appropriate, like Frodo falling on his back and the ring tumbling through the air is a moment of suspended time. You just try and work it as naturally as possible for the drama. Interesting that someone should say that, because I tried to make the slow-mo as unobtrusive as possible, to make it the entry and exit from it as natural, using movement, because even in slow-mo, if something moves through the frame, you can disguise the transition between normal speed and slow-mo. And I think we just try and work that as smoothly as possible.
Did you read the book before you started editing?
Interesting. No, I didn't. My son, who was about 13 or 14, had read it. So I asked him about it. And then, of course, once the film started, I picked up the book and I kind of speed read it. I didn't want to be too enmeshed in the mythology of the book. I wanted not to know it intimately, because the audience wouldn't necessarily be familiar with the book. And I wanted the film to exist on its own and make sense on its own. It had to be a standalone film, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. What about some of those enormous scenes with, you know, the battle scenes? How much footage were you dealing with, and how do you even organize that so you can keep it in your head?
Interestingly, because they were shooting on film, I probably didn't get as much footage as you would get today if they were shooting digitally. But I do remember we had about 2 million feet of film and shot over a period of a year. So we had racks and racks of film. There was no doubt about it. I didn't see that. But we did a film conform when we were screening the film. We would conform a work print and watch it that way. And we watched film dailies as well. We were sat in the theater and watched film dailies at the end of the shooting day. They were selected dailies, luckily. I try and look at as much of it as I can, but there are times when I'll skate through and say, I'm going to pick over this stuff later. You know, you do what you can. What I like to do is I'll get all the dailies for a scene put in a straight line, and I'll just quickly zip up and down there and have a think, okay, how have they covered this scene? And I'll just get an idea in my head of the kind of structure of the scene that I think it should be. And then I'll go into the areas of coverage I think that are important at certain parts of the scene and create a rough of the scene according to the structure I think I want. And then depending on how much time I've got, if I've got to move on, I can put that down, move on to something else. But I like to do a good cut of the scene quite quickly, and then come back 2 days later. And if that little bit of time, I think, is really useful, because you come back and you see it fresh. Whereas when you're working on a scene, turning over in detail, you can lose the big picture. Sometimes if a cut doesn't work, it's not because you can't make it work. It's because you're cutting the wrong things together in the wrong part of the scene. And I can see that much more clearly when I come back a couple of days later. And of course, the scene will play differently when you've got an assembly of scenes around it and you've got a reel. But I think it's important to find the magic moments in various scenes and knowing what you're looking for story-wise in scenes to be able to isolate those things which really are the kind of key parts of the scene or the key parts of the story and have in your mind what they are and build around those. That makes sense.
Do you bother temping at that early stage or are you temping once you've got some scenes together?
It varies from project to project. When I just did a drift with Baltasar Komik, we said, okay, let's not temp this film. Let's just cut it and we'll temp it later. And there are other films, some scenes you think, okay, this is definitely going to need some tension or whatever. Let's try some things. So mostly I try and hold on until I've got a decent run of scenes because temping takes a lot of time to find the right musical tone. And I'm quite often thinking quite early on what kind of music is going to work here. And I'm trying to build a library of the kind of music that's going to work with a film. But I try not to get too wedded to anything too early on.
I really appreciate all of your fantastic wisdom and memories of how this film went together. It's absolutely a classic for cinema. Thank you.
Right. Thanks, Steve. It's nice talking.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, these interviews are also available to read at blog.frame.io, where they're supported with great visual content, images, video clips, and more. It's a great opportunity to check out the other expert content on the blog for filmmakers of all types. Frame.io also has a YouTube channel, including a video Art of the Cut interview with Dune editor and multi-Oscar nominee Joe Walker ACE. And more video interviews are coming soon. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to my guest, John Gilbert, ACE. Thanks to Dylan Giovanetto for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me on Twitter and feel free to reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hallfish. And so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And remember that if you have a friend in the film business or who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.